misiones. ¿Pudiera, por favor, explicarnos esas dos misiones que mencionó usted, describirlas un poco?
La misión RIVA es aquellos estudiantes que en su momento fueron excluidos del sistema educativo y que no tenían oportunidades de estudio, que se dedicaron a estudiar, se casaron y dejaron los estudios. Cuando se comienza, se impulsa la misión RIVA, hace un llamado, ¿verdad?, un censo de toda esa población flotante que está excluida del sistema educativo y que fueran inmersos, inscritos allí. Luego fueron ingresados en cada uno de los planteles educativos porque se municipalizó la educación. Entonces los colegios educativos que cumplían su horario normal, en las noches se convertían en misiones. La misión Sucre consiste en los estudios universitarios de la población, otra forma de integración en el nivel educativo. Y pues hoy también participé en la misión Barrio Adentro. Yo fui una de las personas que recibió los médicos cubanos cuando llegaron a mi comunidad y los impulsamos a nivel de todos los bloques. Yo vivo en Propatria y nosotros integramos un módulo por cada bloque de Propatria. Trabajé con 105 médicos cubanos. Formamos, de ahí salió los módulos octagonales, luego las ópticas, donde se le hacían exámenes de la vista a las personas, y los módulos odontológicos. Asistencia social a la población en todos los niveles. Ese es el gobierno de Chávez.
Un mensaje para esa audiencia, ¿qué le dice usted?
Le digo a esa audiencia que no crea en lo que dicen los medios que están en contra de la política de Estado del presidente. Que vengan aquí a Venezuela y que le pregunten a su pueblo qué es lo que quiere, qué es lo que ha sido Chávez para Venezuela y el mundo. Que no confíen en esos medios de comunicación, que lo que dicen es transversal la información. Aquí, en el pueblo venezolano, en el suelo venezolano, es donde se ve la verdadera democracia, la verdadera integración y la inclusión social que ha hecho el presidente Chávez.
Jefes de Estado y delegaciones de alto rango de más de 50 países también hicieron actos de presencia en Caracas para expresar su respeto a Hugo Chávez. Por otro lado, periodistas y venezolanos residentes en Estados Unidos, a su regreso al país, fueron hostigados por los agentes aduanales en Houston, Texas. Una venezolana fue interrogada por los agentes sobre una supuesta infracción de tránsito que recibiera años atrás. Poco después del hostigamiento, ella y un periodista angelino fueron liberados. En los próximos días, el informativo Pacífica compartirá con sus oyentes las grabaciones de audio hechas en la ciudad de Caracas en los últimos días. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
Ya estás en todas las casas. De la mía no te has ido, no tienes permiso para irte, no tienes permiso para irte, comandante, usted de aquí no se va.
Estás escuchando el informativo Pacífica.
Los invitamos a visitar nuestro blog en pueblosinfronteras.wordpress.com.
Si deseas comunicarte con nosotros, puedes escribirnos al correo electrónico pueblosinfronteras@gmail.com.
Monaguillo pelotero de mi pueblo, esperanza y voz del mundo entero, despiertas la dignidad de los pueblos con tu corazón venezolano.
Jóvenes guatemaltecos se congregarán el miércoles en la capital de ese país para presionar al Congreso a que apruebe la Ley Nacional de la Juventud. Los detalles con la Federación Guatemalteca de Escuelas Radiofónicas.
Para este miércoles está prevista la llegada de cientos de jóvenes de todo el país para hacer un plantón frente al Congreso de la República para exigir a los diputados la aprobación de la Ley Nacional de la Juventud, según lo expresa Jonathan Elí Pérez López, representante de la Coordinadora Departamental de la Juventud de Retaluleu.
Ahorita ya estamos impulsando una manifestación que para el 13 de este mismo mes pensamos ir a la capital y pararnos frente al Congreso. Es una manifestación de alto volumen, prácticamente estaría yendo a Retaluleu y todos los departamentos con sus municipios. Entonces todos los jóvenes iremos a apoyar en lo que es el frente del Congreso para hacer presión al gobierno para que esta ley sea pasada a tercera lectura.
Pérez López agregó que la propuesta de ley 3896, Ley Nacional de la Juventud, que se encuentra estancada en segunda lectura, por lo que exigirán que pase a tercera lectura y su posterior aprobación. El entrevistado lamentó la falta de voluntad política del Congreso para la aprobación de dicha ley, que implica para la juventud guatemalteca una herramienta jurídica para su desarrollo integral.
El dictador argentino Reinaldo Vignone fue condenado el martes a cadena perpetua por haber cometido crímenes de lesa humanidad durante el régimen militar. Los detalles con Noticias RT.
El dictador estaba acusado de crímenes de lesa humanidad realizados en el centro clandestino de Campo de Mayo. El tribunal lo consideró responsable de los delitos contra 23 víctimas, incluidas 7 mujeres embarazadas que dieron a luz en maternidades secretas durante el régimen. Junto a Vignone, quien ya había sido condenado a cadena perpetua anteriormente por otras acciones, fue sancionado el ex comandante de institutos militares Santiago Omar Riveros. La integrante de la Comisión de Juicio Campo de Mayo, Adriana Tawada, opina que todos los dictadores son culpables de genocidio ante la historia.
Todos los imputados, los acusados de este juicio, que es el séptimo juicio de los delitos de lesa humanidad cometidos en el centro clandestino de detención de Campo de Mayo, ha sido condenatorio para todos los acusados. Él ya ha sido, digamos, para nosotros no es una novedad la condena de Vignone, ratifica condenas, como vos decís, condenas anteriores. Desde el año 2010, efectivamente, donde recibió la primer condena, él, como muchos otros genocidas, están detenidos, que tienen prisión domiciliaria. Para nosotros, de cualquier manera, o para muchos de nosotros, lo importante es que la justicia los ha encontrado culpables. No somos nosotros, los familiares o los compañeros de los detenidos y los desaparecidos, los asesinados, quienes decimos que son culpables, sino que lo dice el Estado, luego de un juicio que ha tenido todas las garantías que nuestros familiares no tuvieron. Por lo tanto, aún que cumplan la condena en domicilio, ante la historia, son culpables del genocidio que se ha producido en este país.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento a todos los medios que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Francesca Salas y del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
And now into our English language programming with Spanish-challenged Robert Norris. That's me. I'll be with you for the next 2 hours. And the program is called Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, local political analysis with a focus on civil rights, the search for civil rights in Santa Cruz. Stay tuned.
How's everybody doing? Hey! Happy birthday, Santa Cruz. All right, we're going to do a couple of originals. We're going to do a couple of songs you may not know. If you don't know them, it's too bad. They're good. You should check them out. We'll let you know what they are. But I'm not here to talk. I'm here to sing. So enjoy. Sing it softly,
sweetest dream.
And welcome to Bathroom Spears Broadsides. That was a disc from the street called No Hobo. And the group is Not Quite Home. Or perhaps the disc is Not Quite Home and the group is No Hobo. In any case, you be the judge. Try to give local groups a chance to pelt out their sound. And sometimes I like it, sometimes I don't. I prefer, of course, political lyrics have to do with street stuff. We'll see how that goes. Anyway, welcome. You're tuned to 101.3 FM. Also, if you have gone to freakradio.org and clicked on the little red dot on the transmitter icon on that website, you would have reached the stream of Freak Radio, or I should say, yeah, Freak Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Robert Norris again, and I'll be with you until 8, at which point Uncle Dennis will be coming in with a musical extravaganza that he does every week, called From the Cream to the Dregs, as well as updates from Earth First, which I should be listening to, but almost never do. Once I get out of the studio, I try to forget it until I have to come back, which is usually burden enough. So, anyway, you're welcome to listen to the show, of course, and you're also welcome to call in to the show. And the call-in number is 427-3772. Area code is 831. Again, 831-427-3772. If you've got some news updates, if you've got some comments on something you've heard, if you think something has been missing from the story that's been put out there, if you want to express an opinion, maybe a little far afield even, I'll stop you if I think we're wandering on the wrong road too much so. But I do try to make this a community experience, too, and I would like people to express their views so we can hear what's happening out there. At least so I can, and maybe the rest of you can, too, assuming your radios are existent and working. So give a call in, 427-3772. That's 427-3772. You can also catch me off air at 423-4833, 423-4833, and I'll get back to you. Perhaps you might want to be a guest on the show. Perhaps you have some additional documentation or some refutation that needs to be brought up. That I'm interested in as well. Because, while I just love my own opinions, I certainly like to know when I'm talking through my hat. And I want to know when I'm wrong or when what I'm saying is inaccurate. And if that's the case, it's your responsibility out there, listeners, to let me know. Because in letting me know, you let everybody know. And that's educational for all of us. So, 427-3772 on air, 423-4833 off air. A couple of quick announcements. There'll be two jury trials coming up on Monday. The I guess it's today's the 14th, so that would be the 15th, 16th, 17th, the 18th of March at 9 o'clock. One of them is going to be a trial of Isaac Collins, the Lyrical Eye, who is a poet, African-American activist, was a mainstay of Occupy Santa Cruz about a year and a quarter ago. And he was the only person arrested or even cited, as far as I know, at the April 20th Marijuana Day celebration up on campus, up at UCSC. He was accused of selling chocolate and, or possessing with intent to sell chocolate and butterscotch marijuana drops. He faces several years in prison for this. It's a felony to do that. And apparently they're pushing this. I mean, we are, of course, in a law and order there's a sort of this law and order frost that has delayed the spring that you may have seen it on the city council if you've been watching that on TV or heard about it or read about it in the papers. There is a growing hysteria around needles and a sort of a fanatic ranting about crime, blaming homeless people without any, of course, statistics or real evidence of that. People essentially feeling insecure, having found needles in different places that they didn't expect to find them, now that they're looking very carefully for them, as perhaps is a good idea anyway. But it's become the political rallying cry of the far right, Take Back Santa Cruz in Santa Cruz. And it was quite prominent on Tuesday at the Santa Cruz City Council meeting. And I think it might be interesting to see how the far right attempts to shut down the April 20th smokeout, which is a traditional event up at UCSC when it comes up next month, if they try to do that. Of course, it's ridiculous. We're talking about an herb that is far less deleterious than alcohol, pharmaceutical drugs, or anything else. But it's all a part of this Santa Cruz's too tolerant mentality that is now blaming sort of a cultural attack on the Santa Cruz counterculture community. And it's not new at all. This has always been around. Homeless people have always been labeled criminals simply for sleeping outside, for being poor, for having to take a dump in the bushes because the city has no 24-hour bathrooms, for having to sleep outside when there's no shelter to go to, for getting forced outside by the economic conditions of a city that pays less than the minimum wage. Well, it pays the minimum wage, but the minimum wage doesn't support a lifestyle of even the most primitive kind in Santa Cruz, for I would suspect for the overwhelming majority of workers who work in the restaurants here, for instance. It's been a scandal for decades when various union and labor groups tried to remedy it with raising the minimum wage in Santa Cruz. They were roundly shouted down by those great socialist liberals like Mike Rotkin and Cynthia Matthews and the Santa Cruz City Council, and it was narrowly defeated at the polls. Anyway, the hysteria is rising, and I understand there's a march planned to City Council week after next, Tuesday after next, to demand law and order, kind of the lynch law of 2013, where I think homeless people are in the targets. Although, if you talk to some of the people who are voicing these views, they will insist, oh no, they're just after the criminals, the bad homeless, not the good homeless. They're just after the enabling institutions like the Homeless Lack of Services Center, which doesn't enable very much at all because they don't provide real shelter for more than a handful of people. They do provide meals. They do provide twice a day. They do provide not the best meals, but meals. They provide mail service if you need a mail service and you have the money to kick down a little to pay for it. And I think they have laundry service. But otherwise, they've gotten increasingly stingy, closed, exclusionary in their own practices, and collusive with the police department, simply trying to maintain their own sort of creaming services where they attempt to garner grants and get more money to take care of a relatively few homeless people. Ironically, the homeless people that would be called the good homeless people by the Take Back Santa Cruz type crowd that wants to eliminate the Homeless Lack of Services Center, tying it up with drugs and needles and so forth, but without any documentation, of course, that there is any real connection there. I mean, there are going to be people, there are going to be addicts indoors and outdoors, and certainly some of them will be using the Homeless Lack of Services Center. Some of them are using the emergency room. Some of them are using all kinds of services, and the idea that this is a good way to cut costs by, I don't know, killing every third addict, which I think is the theory behind the needle exchange, although, no, they're just saying they want a more carefully regulated needle exchange. Anyway, I'm going to shut up about this because I've talked about it too much. Instead, I'm going to sort of launch into some interviews after mentioning that there are two trials coming up, one for Isaac Collins. That's what this initial rant was about. That'll be going, it's a felony trial of 3 years in prison is a possible sentence. And that begins on Monday morning unless Isaac pleads out. And I don't know that he's going to do that. I don't think he is. At least I didn't hear that was the case the last time I spoke with him. Another woman who's going to trial for a misdemeanor case of, I think it's resisting arrest, which is, of course, the favorite charge of officers who have nothing to arrest you for, get abusive with you, and then claim you're resisting arrest. She'll be going to, her name is Jess Grabowski, she'll be going to trial on Monday, unless she pleads out, which is often the case, because people don't want to take the risk, particularly with public defenders who are not terribly enthusiastic about their case, who haven't investigated it very thoroughly, who've had very little time talking to their defendants, as has been the case, I think, with both Isaac and Jess. And in any case, they're told, we'll give you a deal. You won't go to jail. You'll get probation. You'll get stay-away orders. You'll get, you'll be able to continue a more apolitical life, because people who are engaged in protests risk having their probation revoked, and it can be very dangerous for them. Thus it was with us when we were the Santa Cruz 11, when I was facing those charges for a year. I had to continually tell myself, go out there and protest anyway, because it's the right thing to do. But, you know, you can have your bail revoked, go to jail until the trial, which would have been in jail for a year. And there wouldn't have been a trial anyway. It would have been dismissed, but I would have been in jail until that time. So it, as would a bunch of other people, 10 other people, over varying periods of time. Without being found guilty of anything, of course, except being critics of the police department, being critics of the district attorney's office, having been in a building with several hundred other people in a protest against Wells Fargo's manifestly and documentedly criminal practices, abusive practices, family-destroying, property-seizing, thieving practices, which I haven't heard a peep from D.A. Bob Lee about, or Chief Vogel, or Mayor Bryant, or former Mayor Don Lane. Not a word. Anyway, that's Santa Cruz as usual. These two trials will be starting on Monday. I will try to give you an update on Sunday if I get more information as to whether they're actually happening there. I believe there's trial readiness today or tomorrow for those two trials, and I should be able to learn more, hopefully, by either the Isaac or Jess contacting me or my getting a hold of them. We'll see how that goes. And I'll talk to you more about their cases. Who knows? Maybe I can even interview them in the studio. A couple of other things are happening. From today until 8 o'clock, there is a anti-cuts organizing meeting up at UCSC at the Baytree Building in the Amma Mutsun Conference Room. Sorry if I got that one wrongly pronounced. And Indy Bay's description of it reads, with impending cuts to health and resource centers, libraries, and academic departments, time for students to build a coalition that can fight for our self-determination and a better university. That's today from 6 to 8, Baytree Building, up on campus, UCSC. Then there's also, at the very moment I'm speaking, a preparation for the Project Homeless Connect that is going to be happening. It is happening, if the Sentinel is to be believed, downtown at the museum right behind Lulu Carpenter's Octagon. That's the place at Front Street and Cooper Street on the corner there, right behind that building. It's a silent auction. I believe there are going to be some speakers about Project Homeless Connect. Homeless Connect, for those who don't know, is an annual event championed by former mayor and current council member Don Lane, whom I affectionately call Gon Lame, who has made an industry out of his homeless advocacy for the last 25 years, or so-called homeless advocacy. No, it's homeless advocacy. It's just I have such a... I hate giving all my fire to people who've been supporting some homeless services throughout the last two decades. But when the rubber meets the road in terms of going for something basic like the right to shelter, the right to sleep without being arrested, they're stopping the downtown ordinances from the massive, persistent harassment of people in public spaces who are poor and homeless, Lane has nothing to say. And I guess that makes me feel he's a phony homeless advocate. He's not a real homeless advocate. He is someone who has a very limited perspective on it, or perhaps just feels that's the only thing that's politically possible. That's usually the reason or the excuse given. Anyway, he's going to be at this thing today, I suspect. I believe that's what the paper was saying. There'll be silent auctions. I don't think there is a charge, and it'll go on for another half hour if you want to go down to the Cooper and Front Street Project Connect kind of prep. I think they're trying to raise money, so they really want you to kick down bucks. Project Connect is an event that happens, as I said, once a year, which does involve making available to 1,000 or more homeless people who show up, or people who are poor and likely to be homeless soon, or just were homeless, access to services, driver's licenses, birth certificates, dealing with some criminal records, perhaps dealing with some tickets, meals at the place, a sort of the housing situation as though there were housing. That's the joke. But that's what all these little booths and all these self-serving poverty pimps will tell you, that, you know, we're here with our little housing project. And it's not that the folks aren't sincere in many respects and sincerely receiving their salaries as they sincerely present their very limited programs with their long waiting lists. It's just that the needs are so much more obvious and so much more easily addressed if people simply talk straight about what's going on and what's not going on, that I get pretty sarcastic about it. And I have confronted Monica Martinez, the head of the Homeless Lack of Services Center there in the past, who has a big fluffy, smiley, feel-good approach with her rhetoric about smart solutions and sustainable solutions and all the current rhetoric, all of which has nothing to do with the most basic issue, shelter or decriminalization of the right to survive while we find housing and jobs for each other. Instead, it's simply hiring more social service people to address the supposed deformities of homeless people that somehow made them homeless. When in fact, of course, what made them homeless usually has very little to do with any personal deformities, but has a lot to do with the way the economic system works. Or such is my belief. And housing and jobs are sort of the basic precursors to this. But you're not going to find much of either at Project Connect. But you will find, you know, a lot of people there to talk to. I think Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, will be there with a table, likely. I've always thought it's a good place for people to go march on City Hall or go march on the downtown area and set up a campground somewhere. I've always thought that's a great thing to do if people are interested in doing it and want to address the possible legal consequences, where, of course, any kind of sleeping at night in Santa Cruz, in a vehicle, outside a vehicle, on any public property and on a much private property, is a crime. Anytime the police choose to pick you off. And that's a real issue. You know, it's not something to be lightly entered into in terms of it's easy for me because I have a place I can go sleep at. But I am concerned that I think these rights need to be restored. And waiting for Christmas doesn't do it. There's other approaches that are being considered. Folks are talking about sustainable campgrounds based on models in other cities, of which there are really none in terms of those that have dealt with the majority of the homeless people in any town. Although I've heard it said that there's one in Petaluma, but I'm still waiting for the documentation on that. I don't think it's true. I think city authorities are cheap. They don't want to deal with the needs of those people that don't vote regularly, don't have much political power, and are pretty scruffy looking. That's not something that they want to do. And it's easier to dismiss them as crazy, drunk, drug abusing, or homeless by choice was the favorite phrase of 20 years ago. Undesirable transient element was the phrase of 40 years ago. bums we shouldn't have any compassion for. Actually, the phrase bums wasn't used at city council night before last, but the overuse of the word, we're sick of being compassionate for poor people. We want to be compassionate for each other because they're in our neighborhoods. They're strewing needles throughout our backyards. We're afraid to take our children to the park, and we can't afford a psychiatrist. You know, I mean, it's... I don't know. Maybe I should go and offer to walk with people to the park so they can feel more comfortable, because I don't feel threatened. I feel threatened by people who want to destroy other people's rights, who want to mobilize other people to hate other people, as particularly the most vulnerable people. I mean, I don't mind, frankly, raising animosity against politicians whose... particularly war criminal politicians, but people in the national scene, but even local politicians who are liars about different issues, and who build their platform on fear and prejudice and bigotry and gentrification as a objective in the downtown area, like Cynthia Matthews does. I have no problem with denouncing that and expressing ill will toward that approach. I really do. And toward people who are, you know, symbolizing that approach and in positions of power to enforce that kind of approach. And I don't feel that's wrong to do. However, you know, when I meet people on the street like this, I mean, I don't really feel any ill will toward them as individual human beings. That's not the issue. The issue is, in a position of power, they have to be resisted, they have to be fought, they have to be essentially dragged down from those positions of power. And, in fact, probably the positions of power themselves need to be dismantled. There needs to be some whole new distribution approach set up. So, it's about 6:30, and I've done my usual time-consuming rant. And if you're still with me, what I'm going to do now... One more thing. Tomorrow there is according to the Santa Cruz Indy Media, a community rally for peace and remembrance from 5:30 to 7:30 in Watsonville at the main plaza to deal with violence in the community, open mic, poetry, art space, painting wall, featuring Gambit, MC Cambio, Bo Clafloja, I hope I got that right, DBD Music, Dementes, and more to be announced. As the sun goes down, we will end with a candlelight vigil and universal prayer. It's a community rally for peace and remembrance. To remember those we have lost to violence in our community, several community leaders, family members of those lost to violence, and youth will be addressing those. And I notice they aren't highlighting Butler and Baker, the two police officers, in this, which... I think it's really a good thing. I mean, I've got nothing, I think there's nothing wrong with expressing concern, particularly if you had a personal relationship with either of these two people, for their violent deaths, or the violent deaths of a number of other people that have died, whether at the hands of the police or at the hands of other people. I'm middle class enough not to like that kind of violence and to be very, very uncomfortable with it. Of course, unless it's happening miles away and I don't have to look at it. And even then, I can fulminate about it. But anyway, it's good that there is a general community rally for peace and remembrance. Although, again, I have yet to see stats that indicate a rise in violence and crime in the last few years. You know, I think I may be wrong. There may be a rise in crime and violence either in the county or in the city, but in the other direction, in that other part. Either there's a rise in the county and a fall in the city, or a fall in the county and a rise in the city. I'm not sure what the story is. But it's not clear to me that this isn't an opportunistic claim for a law and order crowd that simply wants to get rid of a whole bunch of poor people, get rid of a whole bunch of social services, and get rid of a whole bunch of politicians who I probably want to get rid of too, but for different reasons. So it's interesting. I'm going to turn now to some tape that I made, some recordings I made back in last week. It was Monday. Yeah, it must have been Monday. The Santa Cruz 11, the last four, the final four, as I call them, went to court in a preliminary hearing challenge to the preliminary hearing called the 995 motion to dismiss. I'm going to play some of that tape now, and I'll occasionally interrupt if it sounds ambiguous or if I capriciously want to, or if you call in and have got some stuff you want to say. Before I do, however, I will take a deep breath and give you a little more music, and then we'll get into that.
It's cracking. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Motion hearing, actually outside and somewhat before the hearing. It's about 1:10 or thereabouts in front of the courthouse. There's a small band of loyal activists who are here, one reading Street Spirit, the newspaper, the latest March issue, who's also still active in issues around foreclosure. Joy, are you still active?
Oh, yes.
Any updates for those of us who have fallen by the wayside?
Well, we have discovered that the foreclosure system is
just a completely rampantly criminal and fraud and basically a mafia type racketeering situation. It's so bad. They are now to the point where they are foreclosing on homes of people who have paid off their loans years ago. It has gotten so out of control. So it's pretty awful.
Wait a minute. Wasn't I told there was great legislation passed in the state legislature that will address or have addressed these issues?
As a matter of fact, yes, and it has decreased the foreclosures in California 65% since January 1st. So, yes, it has helped. But the system is still in place for the banks to be able to do some things to get around the situation, because they're basically forging documents. And when you have impunity to forge documents, as long as you have the correct documents to provide, you can go ahead and do it anyway. But yes, the Homeowners Bill of Rights has helped a great deal.
So, speaking as an advisor to the legislature, what kinds of reforms do you think are necessary to plug this huge loophole or drain?
It's not legislative, really. It's the, I guess, unless you want to change the law for recorders. What has to happen is that the recorders have to decide that they're not going to accept forged documents, and by law, they're not allowed to do that. They just have to accept whatever documents are given to them. So really, it requires mass public involvement to understand what's going on and to demand a stop to it. Until that happens, it will probably continue. Although we are working in the background, as usual, on trying to get various people who have the power to make changes on the side of the people.
Any idea what's happening in Santa Cruz County in terms of the number of forged documents that are resulting in fraudulent foreclosures or inappropriate robo-signings or dual-track doo-doo, anything of that sort? That's always been a concern of mine, is to find out what's happening locally. Not that I've ever put any energy into it, mind you, but there are those who are interested and more knowledgeable, such as yourself, who might have some info on that.
Well, they can't dual track anymore. That's outlawed.
Explain what that is.
That's when they tell you they're considering you for a modification and they go ahead and foreclose on you anyway.
The significance of this has been that banks were telling people that if they were being considered for a loan modification, they should stop paying their foreclosure payments, and lo and behold, that would result suddenly in them being foreclosed on as they were stalled while waiting to hear news about the potential loan modification that was being dangled in front of their eyes.
Homeowners Bill of Rights forbids that. So if they do try to do that, you can take them to court if you can afford to find a way to do that.
But of course, it doesn't provide for district attorneys charging the banks with criminal behavior. It means you just have to go find yourself a lawyer and sue the bank. I don't think that really sounds like a lot of an improvement, but we hear from Joy that 65% of foreclosures have been decreased by 65% since then, which sounds good.
And you can stop it, or you can get an injunction, whatever. There's lots of ways that are on the side of the people now.
Have they stopped doing that in your experience? And if they haven't, have people had the resources to go to court?
They have mostly stopped. I think there are probably cases where they're finding ways around it. One of the biggest ways that they've, it appears as if they're finding a way around, is to move their servicers overseas so that they no longer, the American laws no longer apply to them. And obviously California wouldn't, a law wouldn't apply to them either. So that's one problematic area. And yes, there's been just a survey done. We got the results just yesterday by one of the people who is really very passionately working on this, CJ Holmes at HOFJ.org. And she did a survey of about 9 counties, just a couple of properties in each county, and found that there was some sort of fraudulent or criminal violation on 100%.
Here in California?
In California. Northern California. Mm-hmm. And the one property that she checked in Santa Cruz did have a violation, so it shouldn't have been foreclosed on.
And, of course, the question is, what have citizens been doing to stop this or respond to this or demand that their district attorneys respond to it, stop prosecuting the whistleblowers, like those who took over the vacant Wells Fargo Bank for 3 days and are now spending, feels like 3 years in court, a nice diversion from the fact that Wells Fargo is doing business as usual. Well, perhaps with some reductions because the dual tracking is now potentially legally, they can be sued for it if anybody wants to. If you have enough money when you're losing your home to go hire a lawyer, and again, I didn't ask Joy about how many people are actually able to do that. Joy is an optimistic woman, as her name kind of reflects. But I don't get a lot of the specifics. I haven't yet gotten a lot of the specifics yet, perhaps because this was a very brief interview. But the real issue for those of us who are looking at the Santa Cruz 11 case is just the blatant irony of activists being doggedly pursued by and using a very bizarre theory when none of them has been found. There's no testimony linking any of them directly with any kind of vandalism, yet they're facing a felony vandalism charge because they walked into the bank in a protest and were seen in the bank sometime during the three-day period, or are accused of associating with those being seen in the bank in the case of Gabriella Ripley Phipps. It's troubling, to say the least.
But that's as we haven't been able to do a broad-based survey yet.
So,
circling, and then he left. I don't know.
What steps do you recommend people? Well, I was going to ask you first. Wells Fargo, of course, is a key figure in the current prosecution because Bob Lee apparently is most concerned. He's our district attorney with getting the money that Wells Fargo had to allegedly had to spend to clean up. Are they involved in overseas, shall we say, moving overseas?
Well, all the major banks are culprits in this. I mean, it's no one. You can't really single out any one of them. They're all bad guys. They're all bad players in that. They all have participated in the foreclosure mills and the falsifying of documents and so forth.
But has our local Wells Fargo moved overseas here? Do we know?
No idea. No idea.
You'll be, of course, researching that and back to us next week.
No, I don't.
And in fact, if somebody wants more information on that issue. Is there an organization that meets regularly on this that you would suggest people talk to?
I'd suggest they go to the HOFJ.org website, and there are daily internet TV shows and tons of resources.
Any local groups still meeting on this?
We have a small group that's meeting, but we meet mostly by telephone and email and so forth, so it's not an official organization. We do have we don't really have a list. So we're kind of in touch with each other through events that we go to.
So no public meetings, which we could ask Wells Fargo executives to come and explain themselves.
Right. Yeah, likely to do that.
Well, thank you, and we've been talking with
Joy.
Thanks, Joy. So I'm in the corridors of the court. It's Department 3. We're outside waiting for the courts to open. And So an incident just happened as we went through the metal detector. Sylvia, a woman in her 70s, with two buttons on her shirt, or sweater actually, one talking about the Santa Cruz 11 and the other, I think, saying I love Occupy, was told she had to take off her sweater, but she's disabled, has difficulty moving her arms, and they wouldn't let her through. So I went back and helped her to take off her sweater under some protest, because I felt this was an unnecessary activity. We did talk to the Sergeant Inez, who we called because it was Deputy Ruiz who made this demand of her. And apparently, according to Sylvia, Sergeant Inez said that buttons were not allowed in the courtroom, which, of course, is Well, I know the First Amendment isn't allowed in the United States anymore, but it's new to me that buttons are not allowed in the courtroom in Santa Cruz. I thought that dark shadow had not yet reached to Santa Cruz, but maybe I'm wrong. I know that Brent himself, Brent Adams, one of the defendants, was hassled for the video camera he has in the corridors here. That was not this time, but on a previous occasion. Good luck. Well, we just got out of the corridors of the court, or into the corridors of the court. The four defendants have been keel-hauled and are being hauled into court. There's going to be a reassessment in April as far as the actual trial, but it's scheduled to begin readiness on May 9th, and then later, 4 days later, it'll begin, I imagine. Alexis Briggs, any comments?
No.
And commend the judge on his wisdom, perhaps?
We'll be preparing a filing, most likely.
What's the next legal filing likely to happen?
In a case in which a 995 is handled in a timely enough manner, you're able to file a writ, which is a mid-procedure appeal to the next highest court. So it would be the district court to review the superior court's ruling on the 995.
The 995 motion is an attempt to suggest that the attempt to even take people to trial is being done without probable cause. And, of course, Judge Volkman, in reviewing the claims by the defense that the arraignment should be thrown out, ruled that no, there was enough evidence to take them to trial. In a ruling that puzzled a number of the defense attorneys and, of course, outraged a number of the people in the audience, there were 30 or 40 people in the audience, all very sedate. There was no tomatoes were thrown, no cries of outrage issued from the audience, which might be a sad thing. I don't know. I mean, because this means more persecution, more harassment for these four defendants, more taxpayer waste of money. And the theory on which they're being charged, well, let's keep listening and maybe we'll hear it discussed. And if we don't, and I feel like it, or you call in and ask at 427-3772, I'll explain it in more detail as I understand it. But unfortunately, the Santa Cruz Four are now going to trial. The four of the Santa Cruz 11 that are left are going to trial in probably the current date is for May. It'll be postponed again because one of the attorneys has a conflict. He has another trial. That's Jesse Rubin, the attorney for Angel Alcantara. The attorney you just heard speaking was Alexis Briggs, who's attorney for Cameron Lorando.
What would the basis for that likely be?
It would be that this judge and the prior judge, or this judge was wrong about that judge not being wrong.
You're criticizing our judges?
I'm saying that's the basis of a writ when you're appealing a 995.
So let it be writ, so let it be done. And we've been talking with?
Alexis Briggs.
Thanks, Alexis. Linda LeMaster, you were here for the trial. Comments, Linda, on the trial, or should we say the preparation for the trial, the 995 hearing?
Actually, no comments that I haven't already made. It just looks like a waste of the confidence of the taxpayers. I only caught the end of it, but that's when the judge is making his decisions, and it didn't seem very decisive to me.
He seemed very tense to me and kind of almost fervent in what he was doing. He seemed very fervent. There's sort of a flashy quality, almost a gritty quality to it. So he was angry about the whole situation. What do I know?
And he hasn't even tangled with that DA ponytail girl.
Tangled with? You mean got entangled with?
He hasn't had to sit and watch what a doofus she can be yet. Has he?
I don't know.
And Linda LeMaster, who herself was recently convicted of illegal lodging for being part of a peaceful protest on the steps of the courthouse. And, essentially, I guess she got a huge amount of community service instead of the up to 1 year jail term that was a possibility. Well, let's hear some more and I'll talk some more.
with a criminal defendant,
Franklin Angel Alcantar.
Franklin, or I should say Angel, what do you think? Are you pleased with the judge's ruling?
You know, that would have been cool if they would have dismissed it, but at the same time, I don't know, it's kind of like, it's kind of exciting to go through trial. I don't know.
That's certainly a novel approach, a very positive viewpoint. Have you seen a psychiatrist lately?
No, but the show has to go on.
Indeed. Thank you. I see your attorney, Jesse Rubin, filed no papers. Did he have any discussions with you about this situation before he came into court?
Well, he told me I probably shouldn't smoke weed before I come into court, but I don't listen because I have a prescription.
Well, Jesse made some good arguments, I thought. Of course, he didn't write anything down, but then perhaps that wasn't necessary. You do seem more, positive about it than the other defendants.
Why should I see a psychiatrist?
I wouldn't recommend anybody see a psychiatrist, actually. But I would say perhaps a couple of sex workers get a couple of new interactions with meaningful relationships.
I'm there.
Masturbate mildly.
Oh, no, I'm cool. I'll pass.
Yeah, we'll wait on that. Brian Hackett, you're attorney for Gabriella Ripley Phipps. You have any reaction to this ruling? Did you expect it?
I was hopeful that the 10,000-pound gorilla in the room, which is this leap of intuition required to make natural and probable consequences apply to a case where aiding and abetting was not proven, I was hoping that would be unveiled in this hearing, and that Judge Volkman may be emotionally removed from, you know, what what's been going on for the last year and a half of this case.
He didn't seem to be, to me.
He seemed neither removed nor connected to it emotionally, in my opinion, but he did not seem to recognize. I think both Ms. McCamey and I tried very clearly to make the argument that you can't just say natural and probable consequences and presto chango, it becomes natural and probable. There's a legal analysis with steps and elements that need to be established, granted at a lower burden of proof at a prelim, but a burden of proof nonetheless.
What is that sequence? Did you outline it actually?
Yeah, I outlined it ad nauseum in my brief. And
you know, I'm going to have to pierce through this legal mist here. All these defendants, all four of them, are being charged with two crimes. One is a crime of trespass, failing to leave a property when directed to do so, of which there is scant evidence, by the way, in terms of the actual elements of that crime, which requires a really official warning that is heard, and then the person's failure to leave. That is, doesn't seem to me to be present in these cases explicitly, for sure. Or at least it's ambiguous that it was there. Secondly, then the more serious charge is felony vandalism. You would think that would mean, you know, they were seen breaking windows, smashing furniture, at least writing something on the wall. The answer is no. None of that were they seen doing. All they were seen doing was going into the building or being in the building at different times. A lot of people were seen going into and coming out of the building and aren't being charged. Were charged and the charges were dropped, like myself and the other seven defendants of the Santa Cruz 11 who are no longer facing those charges. Although we did pretty much the same thing in many ways that these four defendants did, at least in terms of the evidence presented in court. I mean, it's the same flimsy, isn't even circumstantial, but how do you get from being in a building to felony vandalism? Well, what Rebecca Young, the district attorney doing this case, is claiming is that, and there's a provision in the code section that she's hanging this argument on, it says that if you aid and abet a crime, and then the natural and probable consequences of that crime are another crime, you are guilty of that other crime, even if you had nothing to do with it, in terms of actually doing that other crime. But there has to be a perpetrator of the other crime. You have to have been shown to intended to and actually did aid and abet the perpetrator in the first crime, the trespass crime. And there was no showing whatsoever that any of these defendants aided and abetted anybody else in a trespass. There was a claim that they trespassed themselves, but there was no claim that they, specific evidence for any indication that they aided and abetted anybody else, which is the basis. I know it sounds ridiculous because, you know, even if there were that kind of evidence, how does that lead to felony vandalism? Well, the theory of the court is, well, there's a large bunch of people. If you aid and abet somebody else in committing a trespass, then you are responsible for whatever they did afterward, particularly if it was a necessary and probable consequence of the first crime. It's never been shown in a court that trespass, that vandalism is a necessary and probable consequence of trespass per se. I mean, it just, you know, trespass is one thing, vandalism is another. Secondly, you have to have somebody who you're aided and abetted, and there's nobody they aided and abetted specifically. At least there was no evidence that they did that, only there was claims that they trespassed themselves. Then you have to show that there was actual vandalism committed by a perpetrator, and that somehow you aided and abetted that perpetrator in trespassing to then cause the vandalism. And that they've got nobody that's a perpetrator of the vandalism. So it is all incredibly thin and incredibly cooked up in order to find somebody to blame and somebody to pay off Wells Fargo. But I don't think any of these four defendants have the $23,000. By the way, much, much more has already been spent on this court proceeding than that $23,000. By the courts, by the prosecution, and by the taxpayers in funding the defense, because the defendants, most of them, have public defenders or had public defenders when they were being charged. So it's a huge cavalcade of weirdness in the sense that there's no substantial benefit to the public other than a sort of a law and order stance being shown by DA Bob Lee and his, I think she's mendacious as well as incompetent, as of say lying as well as incompetent district attorney is doing all this, the underling Rebecca Young. I mean, I think she's doing it because she's been assigned to do it. She's trying to dot her I's and cross her T's and find the whatever in the law books can keep people in this machine that's eating them up and that might prove to have to get a conviction somewhere along the line if they can exhaust everybody or maybe force them into a plea deal. But she's already been sanctioned once with a $500 sanction for disobeying the judge's orders to provide the information that defense kept asking for, the police reports, the video, it was the videos primarily, and other documents that she insisted she'd given over, but which she hadn't. She either lied about it, or she was fantasizing about it, or she forgot about it, but this happened so much. I made at least three or four different demands at different times through two different attorneys on my case. And she lied about it. She misstated at best and lied at worst about it to the judge. The judge then ordered her to bring it in, and she still didn't bring it in. And the judge still didn't do anything other than give her a $500 sanction instead of dropping the charges, which really would have been an appropriate sanction. And also paying the money that it cost attorneys to come from out of town to defend the clients. Several of them are from out of town. Their traveling expenses, they're going to court, they're preparing motions, which were ignored by Rebecca Young, the district attorney, in terms of just demanding again and again, where's the video that shows your case? Where's so we can see what's going on? And I still don't think they have all the video, but that's just my opinion. Others who have watched it, like Brent Adams, feels that they have all the video, but I think Brent can be too generous with authorities, but that's just my feeling. Continuing with, again, we're listening to Brian Hackett, who is a Gabriella Ripley Phipps attorney.
And again, I refer to the elements in CalCrim 401 where it says, you know, in order to aid and abet the target crime, there are the four elements. But on top of that, it flies in the face of Judge Burdick's ruling because he specifically said they did not aid and abet the target crime. They committed the target crime individually and by doing so aided and abetted the vandalism.
The target crime being trespass.
Rebecca Young's response say that that there are some cases found that aiding and abetting and committing, in essence, can amount to the same thing as far as trespass goes.
Well, aiding and abetting, if I'm understanding the point in Ms. Young's response that you're referring to, aiding and abetting can amount to culpability as if you committed it yourself. That's the whole this sort of theory that they're going under that they're not neither establishing nor proving is if one aids and abets the target crime.
trespass in this case, and then a vandalism is committed by one of the people with whom you aided and abetted the trespass, and that vandalism is proven to be a natural and probable consequence of
foreseeable natural regard,
then you are guilty of the vandalism as if you committed it yourself. That's the whole sort of theory, but it's just out there in the ether, and nobody is bothering to consider that we haven't established the elements of the aiding and abetting, and it was actually directly at odds with the judge's ruling that this was a spontaneous event, that people did it individually. We don't even know who the perpetrator is. And as Ms. McKamey pointed out, show me a case where we don't know who the perpetrator of the foreseeable act was, and yet culpability is found for the aider and abettor of the target crime.
And yet Judge Volkman said, take him to trial.
Essentially, he said, you know, there's enough for this extremely low standard of proof at the preliminary hearing. So, potentially, I've talked with co-counsel. I'm waiting for the transcripts of this. When I get them, we'll talk about filing a writ to the 6th and see if maybe we can get cooler heads to prevail.
How long does that take if you do file a writ?
God only knows. Let's see how long it takes to get the transcripts.
One thing is, can you do that? Can you delay trial until the writ?
Absolutely. Yeah. If we file a writ, we absolutely will have the authority to file a 1050 and continue the trial until such time as the higher court determines what the issues are.
But you have to do it. You have to get the transcript before the trial comes, or else you lose your opportunity to file the writ?
No, we could continue and say we're waiting for the transcript. I don't anticipate the transcript's taking that long. My concern is whether or not we get them quick enough to put together a writ and be back before Judge Burdick on April 8th to say, hey, we're filing a writ, we have the transcripts, or we file the writ, et cetera, et cetera. So,
and what time on April 8th should people come if they wish to be supported?
At 8:15, yeah.
Will there be muffins?
There will be muffins and hot coffee.
Whoa! Very sweet of you, Brian. Thank you. That's Brian Hacker.
And I talked with Brian today. He advised me that he's been told the transcript will be ready at the beginning of next week of this latest hearing, which he may well be preparing an appeal to the San Jose District Court, suggesting that this tortured theory of aiding and abetting just doesn't go, because these guys aren't even accused of this woman and the three men involved are not accused of. They're accused of trespass and felony vandalism, and the judge in the earlier court ruled that they didn't aid and abet a trespass, they trespassed. Or at least that's the evidence. There's enough evidence for them to go to trial on that. Not that hasn't been proved, but it's he believes there's enough evidence. I don't. I mean, even if you were to accept the literal meaning wording of the law, I don't think so. In any case, he's told me that they'll probably have an appeal put together, either even without the transcript, if it doesn't come out in time. They have 15 days from March 11th to appeal this to the district court. And the district court, and then if that fails, they have to appeal it to the California Supreme Court, all of which is costing more taxpayer money and wasting everyone's time in order to defend the face of Bob Lee and Police Chief Vogel. And maybe, I don't know, satisfy the banksters over at Wells Fargo and the law and order crowd that somehow sees this as some proof of law and order in Santa Cruz, that these phony prosecutions are continuing.
Any comments about this bullshit? She shakes her head and stretches. Thank you.
Oh, well, you know, I had read Mr. Hackett's fiery, fine brief.
This is Becky Johnson speaking.
Regarding this case, and it seemed to me that they were pointing out an error in the preliminary hearing where Gabriella was, the judge asserted that she was seen in the building when she wasn't. The only evidence that she was in the building was Headley when he testified that in one of the copious amounts of videotapes he'd reviewed, he remembers seeing a videotape of her going in and out of the building. And they said, well, which video was that? Because we couldn't find it.
Let me interrupt you, because they're actually, before you arrived, Judge Volkman described what he felt was the evidence that was leading him to his decision in the Gabriella's case, and he stated it was the fact that she was found to be a spokesperson for the group, and that was the reason.
Please never say there's...
But if you can't believe the police, who can you believe? Yeah. And actually, the evidence that they claimed that she said that she was a spokesperson for the group. But she never, of course, testified to that effect, and there was no, well, I guess there was police testimony. They regarded her as that.
Actually, I thought
the police actually were the ones who requested Gabriella, by their own testimony, act as an intermediary, and then they dubbed her spokesperson for the group, which, of course, has tied her up in these prosecutions. So her good deed in acting at the police request as a spokesperson, a spokesperson for the police, actually, as an intermediary between the police and the Santa Cruz, the people inside the building, and when she was never inside the building herself, at least according to any evidence presented in court, that good deed has resulted in her current situation and this cooked-up case against her.
From the police was that she was just the messenger.
I think they said various things. There is a transcript online for those who want to read the entire 265 pages, generously provided by Alexis Briggs and generously posted by your very famous reporter, Robert Norris. Any other thoughts?
Always interesting reading.
Perhaps. Becky, we'll be talking with
Becky Johnson.
Thank you, Becky.
And if you do want to read more about the case, you can go to the Santa Cruz Indie Media website, indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. It's a great photographic display of the folks in the corridors of the court, done by Alex, by Alex DeRosi. And there's a new story about Bradley Allen and his struggle as a member of the Santa Cruz 11, in essence, to stand up for the principle that journalism is not a crime. That's also on the Santa Cruz Indie Media website. I recommend people take a gander at that. There was a story that came out the next day in the Santa Cruz Sentinel, which I don't have any really strong feelings about it. I put it out on the Huff website. On the Huff email, which actually makes its way to the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org, for those of you who want to check out the website. I made some notes, which I really have kind of gone over here, but I'll read this a paragraph or two. Former Santa Cruz 11 defendant and photojournalist Alex DeRosi covered the hearing at the address on the Indie Bay website that you can go to, and I presented my own take with links to the motions filed to dismiss, so-called 995 motions, that were themselves set aside by Judge Volkman, sending the case instead to trial. Regarding the trespass charge, it was selectively enforced and seemed to be done as a political sop to anti-Occupy authoritarians, as well as a form of SCPD face-saving. Plus, it seemed a pretty convenient opportunity to go after activists long publicly critical of police misconduct and alternate media whistleblowers. If there was a real concern about trespass, it should have been a timely bust done within 24 hours of the occupation and uniformly applied to everyone there. Clearly, this was a combination of tokenism, scapegoating, I should say cherry-picking rather than tokenism, but scapegoating and intimidation against other direct-action critics of Wells Fargo and large corporate criminals. In other words, only 11 people were charged out of the 150 who were in there, or more. Free speech and free assembly considerations also play a significant role, not to mention the community reality that the building was long vacant and has remained so. And I'm told there are people actually sleeping outside that building as well as outside other vacant bank structures. Prosecutions in a dozen other cities have led to acquittals or been dropped for similar occupations. First Amendment protections are an explicit part of the 602 trespass statute, which these four are now charged with, which are ignored by both the prosecution and the defense, the First Amendment provisions. In terms of harm reduction, the vacant bank could have provided shelter for a population, homeless people, but has a far higher death rate than the terrified mob that showed up at city council ranting about needles, drug addicts, the homeless, and crime. Regarding the felony vandalism charge, prosecution witnesses agreed there was zero evidence of explicit documented vandalism by any of the four, not to mention the 11 originally charged, nor were any vandals, other vandals, identified. The discredited assistant district attorney pursuing this case, Rebecca Young, was already sanctioned $500 for repeatedly violating court orders and keeping evidence from the defense, as I said earlier. To justify this prosecution, Young adopted a tenuous, torturous aiding and abetting theory, which we've already discussed, and natural, probable, and foreseeable consequences, the wording in this tortured statute that they're trying to use. And you can read all about this if you go on to Santa Cruz Indie Media.
What did you think of the behavior of the deputies prior to the trial?
I think they were pretty distracting.
Excuse me.
Well, here we go again.
We move it down, please. Thank you.
And speaking of which, yes.
Well, I just generally felt like their walking around was kind of unnecessary, and it was difficult to track what the judge was saying and the initial defense attorneys when they were beginning to make their statements. I felt like they were doing a lot of unnecessary shuffling around. But
prior to the actual arrival of the judge?
Well, just staring people down and fingering their belts, but that's pretty typical, right?
Well, they did make some comments about video cameras and tape
recording. Oh, right, of course. Yeah, there was no videotaping to be done so that there could be no real concentrated tracking of the trial proceedings. So, yeah, definitely transparency was hindered by that.
It wasn't even that there was no videotaping. It's that there was no videotape machines allowed to be present.
That's right.
Which is a new, it shows, again, a lack of trust in the public.
And, in fact, this is an example of a tightening, a twisting and a tightening of the knot that we're all finding around our necks with increasing police state processes. I carry a tape recorder with me wherever I go, including into court. I don't use it unless I have been granted permission, which is ridiculous, of course, by the court. Shouldn't be any problem with using a tape recorder. They claim that they want to have an official record. Well, they have an official record, and I would say the public is also entitled to its official record. But in any case, the only other occasion on which I was, a bailiff came over to me and told me that I couldn't have a tape recorder with me, I denounced that. I complained about it, and I essentially got what amounted to an apology from the deputies. And in the future, I didn't find that. This happened about a year or two ago. On Monday, when I went into court, Brent Adams had a video camera, and Alex DeRosi had a still camera, and they were told they could not have those devices in the courtroom, and also that if anyone were seen with a cell phone that was turned on, it would be confiscated. Again, intrusions on the personal privacy of each of the members of the public and intimidating them from even considering making a record. Sounds a little bit like they're treating every hearing like a Bradley Manning hearing. And even, as we know, at the Bradley Manning hearing, the individual who was who leaked the collateral murder video and the various other documents that revealed massive abuses by U.S. authorities and others so that the world could see what was going on, and has been held in prison for 3 years without trial until recently, when now he's facing massive punitive charges for, in essence, serving as a reporter to the American people about what their government, what their military is doing. Somebody in that court martial, people were not allowed to actually get a transcript of the trial. Someone had to sneak a transcript out. Well, I think somebody was keeping a record of it by writing it, but somebody made a recording of it, which was played on Amy Goodman. That sort of high level of bogus security, which really is an attempt to make it more difficult for people to get an accurate understanding and assessment of what's happening at the government level is happening here in Santa Cruz as well. Bad news, folks.
But why should we? Trust your police, not your public.
That's what I'm saying.
There you go. That's what we're all saying these days. After all, remember, Baker and Butler rule.
Yeah, exactly. America back in business.
Thank you. We've been talking with...
Robert North.
True. Talking to that hot-headed woman.
Danica DeFoy.
Danica, I know you recently went over to the East Coast to hang out with that criminal traitor, Bradley Manning.
Yeah, Bradley Manning is a hero, and he is being called a traitor by our government. And strangely enough, they're now charging him with aiding the enemy for giving out information about war crimes. So, again...
Well, they're aiding the...
people, yeah, they're aiding
the people. People being the enemy in this case.
Yeah, right.
Well, we know the people don't really know best in these cases. The government must be trusted to make the important decisions. Experts, after all, know what we should do.
Well, I think most people would disagree with that, Robert. And even though you're being facetious, I think that there is a danger here in that the precedents being set in all these cases are going to affect our future, whether it be Bradley Manning or the Santa Cruz 11. And I think that sometimes people in this area get apathetic and don't realize that there are precedents being set that can affect themselves and their children.
So what struck you most about your trip back east? How long were you there, first of all?
I was only there for a week. I was supposed to be a vacation, but it turned into kind of a disaster. But my one highlight was going to Bradley Manning's hearing on November the 8th. And upon entering the gate, the guard did tell me that they hoped they took him out back and shoot Bradley Manning. And it was really scary because they were talking about delaying all this information and the classification of information. And they've overclassified to the point that they can delay your trial if they feel like it indefinitely, basically. So we have indefinite detention being, I guess, worked in as a common theme throughout some of the modern trials. And also, you know, with drones and calling everyone a terrorist that's an activist, this should really wake people up, I think.
What prompted the guard to say that he suggested that Bradley be given the lead bullet treatment?
I identified myself as a Bradley Manning supporter, and the guard gave me a stern look, and this was, you know, a white Virginia gentleman, obviously military, and he said, I hope they take him out back and shoot him. And, you know, I didn't know what to say. I wanted to respond in a rude manner, but I was afraid I was not going to get onto the base, and I was afraid that was his point in doing so. And I was also given information that was told to several members of the press there, as well as Bradley Manning's cousin, who had attended the hearing. And this is really concerning because you can tell that they're trying to commit vigilante justice. I almost had a Freudian slip. But yeah, I think Angel's laughing. But yeah, I think definitely this is a scary case. And it was really powerful for me because I've been harassed for speaking out about this case to see Bradley Manning because he's such a... I don't know. I think he's like one of those people that radiates goodness when you see him. And he has a small stature, but he is such a beautiful soul. And I think that the crime that he's charged with is exposing war crimes. So if anybody wants to find, you know, any kind of like information about Bradley Manning, they should go to bradleymanning.org.
And we've been talking to that traitor at large.
Danica DeFoy, and just want to brag that on Twitter I was called a whore by Roseanne Barr after she was talking about feminism. So just to throw that out for fun for you, Robert.
You had evidence of your sexual services?
No, actually it was because I said that one could wear high heels and also be a protester. And she said if you wore high heels, you were a doped up whore. And she followed me on Twitter, but I just thought that was kind of sad. And, you know, it reminded
me. Invite her to the next slut walk?
No, but it reminded me of some of the disingenuous stuff that goes on that I was just speaking to another gentleman here. And it's like, I think that a lot of people have to have some real conversations in Santa Cruz. And we've experienced recent really sad police violence. And I think that having real conversations is something that would help heal the entire community, realizing that there are catalysts to certain kind of violence and that sort of thing.
Any particular police violence you're referring to?
I was talking about the police, the shootings of the officers that happened, but also the fact that I was saying that there is a catalyst to sometimes to the attitudes towards the police that creates a dangerous situation for both protesters, citizens, and the police. And I think that if we could have a common communication and maybe see each other as people instead of enemies, that would no longer be the case. And I think with the militarization of the police, that it's become more and more dangerous for both sides, but increasingly so for the protesters, because we are not there with weapons. And I did actually, excuse me, a couple weeks ago, for another Bradley Manning event, meet Scott Olson, who was shot by the Oakland police. And somebody asked him, you know, are you going to be okay? And she didn't really get it. He said, you know, I'm not ever going to be okay, because he has brain damage. And that just kind of highlights the situation for me on both sides, that we have a lot of healing to do, and we need to have some real conversations.
And there you have it. Again, we've been talking with Danica DeFoy. You can find, you have a website?
Yeah, you can look up Danica DeFoy Tumblr, and I have a photo blog. I don't really do a lot of self-promotion anymore. I used to do a radio show, but again, I got harassed and censored so by the progressive community here, so I just am a little bit annoyed by that, and I think that
there's... Why were you censored by the progressive community? What issues did they find worthy of censoring you on?
Well, there's Bradley Manning created, my support of Bradley Manning created quite a bit of tension, and there is a famous woman named Christine Kraft that was called in who was harassing me on the chat room, and then there was a friend of the owner who still harasses me.
The owner of?
Of KRXA.
You were a regular broadcaster?
Yes, I was, yeah, and unfortunately it got to be a really messy situation, and I think that it also, you know, it just shows that we have these communities and we could really get together and have something powerful, but there's sometimes one or two individuals that just create a huge problem, and unfortunately I think it's going to really hurt progressive radio around here, because I love freak radio, but let's be honest, we need more progressive radio and more voices out there, not less.
Volunteered to make your services available to KSCO?
I have not. I'm a little disillusioned with it, and like I've said before, it does cost money. I mean, there's the reality of the situation that you do to do a good radio show. You do have to have a little bit of money, and for me, a producer, because I do like to do a quality show if I can. And I might get back into it, but I also think that, you know, if the supporters were a little bit more fast in their beliefs, then I would be a little bit more apt to jump back in, I think, too.
Thank you, Danique.
You're welcome, and thank you, everybody.
You're here. I'm here at Red Church Land, and it's about 15 after 5 on the 11th of March.
Red Church Land is, of course, the Calvary Episcopal Church, and that's the church right across from the Farmer's Market and the Nickelodeon, where there's a meal every Monday night. And that's where I go to chat with people. Just got a quick visit from Brent Adams, one of the Santa Cruz 11, out of the final four, with his latest flyer, Santa Cruz Sanctuary Camp, Let the People Sleep. He has a radio show tomorrow night. I'm sorry. I thought this was Sunday, and it wouldn't be tomorrow. It would be Tuesday. Tuesday night, he has a radio show called The Burning Flag. And he writes on the back of this, welcome to the beginning of a new conversation. We all know that our homeless problem is beyond acceptability. We are seeing some new ideas sprout lately, including 180-180. Homeless Connect is quite helpful in meeting some needs. Despite the $2 million spent on homelessness each year in the county, the large majority have no place to sleep at night. It is illegal to sleep outside between 11 p.m. and 8:30 a.m. Many of the problems that are associated with homelessness can be attributed to the lack of this basic human need to sleep. People are often forced to stay awake all night to avoid ticketing. People must keep their possessions with them in backpacks or large carts so that it isn't taken when trashed by police or removed or stolen by others. There aren't adequate garbage receptacles in the natural areas. There aren't adequate bathrooms, porta-potties in natural areas. Camps in the woods increase fire danger, syringes, and other biomedical waste. People sleeping or loitering with large camps and parks and residential, business, and tourist areas. Police report 30% of their budget is spent dealing with homelessness. I would say harassing the homeless, dealing with homelessness, not dealing with homelessness, trying to eliminate the visible homeless. But I don't know how much of the budget actually goes for that. Continuing with Brent's analysis. All across the country, sanctuary tent cities are proving that homeless-related crime drops dramatically. Natural areas are less spoiled. Residential homeless and residential business and tourist areas have fewer homeless loiterers. I hate that phraseology. People begin to rebuild their lives. Drugs and alcohol abuse drops. It has been shown that people move up and out of homelessness via sanctuary camps. Like our Facebook page, Santa Cruz Sanctuary Camp, or go to santacruzsanctuary@gmail.com. And this is another one of Brent's graphically impressive flyers. And you'll probably be seeing a lot of those around town. You are tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Brent's show is 10 o'clock on Tuesday nights. It's called The Burning Flag, and I think he may be rebroadcasting it as well. But you can check that out. And it may even be archived at some point at some place, but I'm not sure. This show that you're listening to now will be archived at huffsantacruz.org, huffsantacruz.org. Let's go to some of those street interviews from the Red Church, or the lawn in front of the Red Church.
Boyd, and Boyd, you say that with the return of Baker's blue shirts, there is now a change in the attitude of the police department?
Most definitely. During the memorial, well, there were sheriffs and out-of-town police working Santa Cruz beats. It was quiet. It was peaceful. People weren't getting bothered. People seemed overall pretty calm and pretty mellow.
And have you noticed anything specific in the last couple of days?
Besides SCPD showing a trying to make a pretty big show of force, not a whole lot.
What kind of show of force have you seen?
Heavier numbers. They're still doing the usual harassment of everyone.
An example of which would be recently.
I haven't really seen much in the way
you
of harassment
earlier,
lately.
Like, how many cops were wrapping
around? Oh yeah, there was three squad cars for one guy being arrested, and he wasn't resisting, he wasn't doing anything, he was just calmly going in handcuffs.
Where did this happen?
I want to say.
Where the fountain was.
Cooper? Pacific and Cooper?
And about what time?
Probably about 2.
Today?
Or? Yeah, today.
Do we have any sense of what he was being arrested for?
No, not at all. We did see an officer drive up and get out of his hot car rather suddenly. We thought we were the ones going to be harassed, but...
Someone else took the bait. Or
yes,
took the brunt.
Yes. Yes, most definitely.
There's some talk about a campground being set up. Have you heard anything about that?
I've heard a few rumors here and there about it. Nothing that sounded too concrete. I wouldn't mind at least checking it out.
I think that there's some meeting tomorrow at noon at Loudoun Nelson Park, but I don't know who's doing it or what the story is. So.
Well, might want to actually be there for it then. Cool.
We've been talking with...
Void.
Thank you, Void. Give the name of the person who's talking to me, because she or he is planning to depart for a trip to the east. But there was a sleeping ticket that reached this person on Saturday morning, or was it Sunday morning?
Saturday morning.
Saturday morning. And was this a 17 police officer ticket or a one police officer? And did you get a warning, told to go somewhere else? Were you sleeping in the middle of the road? What was the deal?
Just got a citation.
It was a citation.
Yeah.
So was this a citation that and I'm intentionally giving you a less than direct version of this person's voice, because I don't want you to recognize him. He's actually a famous United States senator who's fallen on hard luck. Just kidding, folks, but he's known to some of us. Were you sleeping alone?
It doesn't matter.
Were you the only one who got a ticket?
I don't think that matters.
That doesn't matter either. Were there more than 5 tickets given?
No.
Good. And was this a police officer you recognized?
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't. But newcomer, perhaps?
I don't recognize too many of them. So.
I got you. Well, you know what they say? Sleep soundly.
Yeah, right.
A final question is, what time of day did you zap it, brother?
About 5:30.
In the morning?
Yeah.
And was this on private or public property?
It was kind of private, I guess.
You were poo-pooing all over the place?
No.
You were snoring?
No. I wasn't disturbing anybody.
But you were sleeping without a permit.
I guess so.
You can't get a permit.
It's against the law to be homeless here in America. It's a crying shame, you know. It's supposed to be a free country, but where's the freedom at when you can't even sleep outside or do anything like that? You know, it's kind of insane.
Perhaps the East Coast will have more freedoms.
I seriously doubt that. It's plagued all over, so, you know. Any time that you want to do something that is free from the system, they seem to want to, you know, cage you in and tell you that you have to do whatever is in the box, and it's not right. You know, some people think outside the box, and it's not right for other people to dictate how they live or how they should live, you know.
Well, I wish you luck on your journey.
Thank you.
You're welcome, man. We have a street spirit vendor who's apparently being told by people who run General Assistance that she cannot essentially get this for donation product that she passes out on the streets for donation and still get full GA. Is that right?
Yeah, I can't get any GA. I was told in December that I should not sell it at all. And I think she kind of tricked me into telling her the truth in January that I was still selling them, and I was willing to report how many I was selling, and she sent me a letter in February saying that she was going to cut me off from GA if I couldn't prove how many I was selling. So I went in the next day after I got this notice, and I filled out this sheet that, you know, is a tip sheet, basically, showing how much money I'd made in January from selling street spirits, a whole $28. And for that $28, I thought filling out this piece of paper was going to be enough to prove that I was being honest and, you know, so signed it and said, and then thought that that would be fine, that I would not get cut off from GA with this threatening letter. And come March, I find that I am not receiving GA anymore. I'm still getting food stamps, but not general assistance.
And how much were you receiving?
Well, there was a check going to my landlord for $280 that has been cut off now. And then above that, I was supposed to receive up to $70 minus whatever I made from selling the street spirits. And that, so in January, I received 40 whole dollars, or like 41 whole dollars for... because I told her that in December I'd made $30.
Hence your appearance at the Red Church meeting.
Correct. I have to supplement my food stamps with something else just to get by.
So my advice, of course, to people in your situation is get some advice from an advocate who actually knows something, and I'm not one of those, about GA and the bureaucratic labyrinth you have to go through. Otherwise, you will probably tell them the wrong thing. It's like trying to deal with some other bureaucratic organizations. You have to know exactly what levers to pull, what information to give, what things not to say, and so forth. Linda LeMaster is a good person to go to for this kind of information.
And in fact, as fate would have it, who should be calling in but the very same Linda LeMaster. Hi, Linda.
I didn't know you were going to give me a plug, or I'd have waited a few more seconds.
Ah, well, I didn't either. But you had some thoughts about what you've heard from, this is actually a Roman Raven who sells street spirit, or was selling street spirit on the Santa Cruz streets downtown.
I talked to her. We talked about this. In fact, I felt really bad because only a month before I was encouraging her to try to go to GA, and I feel like I created a whole ticket of crap for her and other people sometimes. But there are ways to appeal that, because the general assistance program is pretty simple. It's generated locally. It gets very little attention from the politicians and bureaucrats, and, you know, it's kind of like a stepchild of county serving agencies in a way, which we'll talk about that some other time. But what I wanted to say is, you know, Hoff could do something on behalf of everyone that is so impoverished or sub-impoverished that they need to appeal to the county's general assistance program without people having to individually go through this crap. And Hoff, as an organization, rather than a person trying to get the benefits, could go directly to the Board of Supervisors instead of having to crawl up the bureaucratic chain from wherever they put the stepchild program. And this is my thought, if Hoff were to do it. I'm not recommending this exactly for an individual, although you should write a letter asking about anything that doesn't add up on your own behalf. Hoff could say, this person is being accused of making $28 all month from selling newspapers to people, but it cost her like $128 to make the $28. And if we argue that, since there's no policy one way or the other behind their position, as far as I know, unless things have changed a whole lot in the last 6 years, then they would either have to create something fair, and then we could hold them to the county's minimum wage standard as a fairness doctrine, and they might end up being able to raise the whole general assistance amount. They've been so snivelly about it. They don't care if people make it or not. I mean, I suppose they copied the Social Security Administration's disabled program if they're giving people up to 70 of real dollar money. You know, I mean, that's more or less how it's been. It doesn't even keep up with inflation, but whatever rationale they're using is inadequate for the real lives of people who live in Santa Cruz County and have to deal with what things and housing cost in Santa Cruz County.
So,
it helped draft the letter. If Huff had the will and inclination to support the letter, you know.
I would encourage you to bring that letter, draft such a letter, and bring it to the next tough meeting. I suspect you'd find receptive ears.
I'll work on it. I'll talk to Becky or some other Huffy guy or Huffy girl.
Okay, and just send it around to the Huff, to some Huffsters, and get their input, or, you know, let them know that's what you're doing. I'm wondering, are there other organizations that actually are concerned about the rights of people on GA as there are in bigger cities?
More than are in bigger cities? I don't think so. Is that what you said?
No, is there any organization in Santa Cruz such as there are in bigger cities?
Well, but that's their primary focus? I don't think so. I don't know of it. But somebody that's eligible for GA is eligible for legal aid-funded organizations support, which gives you some lawyeriness. And the legal aid would be listened to by the County Board of Supervisors even faster than a non-credentialed bunch of us.
Interesting. Well, listen, I encourage you to prepare such a letter. Maybe it could be sent to legal aid as well. And I will talk with you more about it off air. Is there more you want to say about that?
Yeah, just that people that are new to having to ask for these kind of what they call public benefits despite the restrictions, know that it's not your fault when you find one program contradicts the next. They don't fit together like Russian nesting dolls at all. They fit together like some sort of burr in your pants.
Nicely put. Thank you, Linda.
Mm-hmm.
And phone lines are open, 427-3772, 427-3772. Give a call. Let's go back to interviews from Monday at the Red Church.
She already said that she would help me, and I think what they're looking for is somebody to sign a piece of paper saying how much money I'm making or how many street spirits I'm getting donated to me to sell. But what I really find offensive is that she's telling me I shouldn't exercise my right to free speech and freedom of the press.
The GA person.
Right. I mean, she's telling me I shouldn't sell these papers, and to me this is a this, I would do this even if I'm making $1 million a year. This is my self-expression.
Well, luckily I have some papers for you today. Should you wish to continue your selling activities, we've been talking with
Raven.
Thank you, Raven. Anything else you wish to say?
No, I'm good.
So we have a report from a library. Your name, sir, if you wish.
John Smith.
Hey, John Smith. And what did you find?
This big goofy guy, he goes around every 20 minutes getting right on people.
You can't sleep. You're going to have to leave
it. It's just not, it isn't even a library. It's horrible.
And this was today you heard this?
It's been going on now for a while. But, see, I live outside. They come after me at night. They shine a flashlight in my, this has been going for years. Now they're actually in the library. Okay, if someone's acting up. Well, I don't know, but this isn't people acting up. They're going after someone who's just sitting there with a book,
nodding out.
Yeah, right. It's not good.
Thank you, John Smith. So here we are talking to two ne'er-do-wells who actually, they have a thing called Cafe Huff. What is Cafe Huff, Bing? What is Cafe Huff?
Cafe Huff is coffee on the street with literature, because the revolution runs on weed and coffee.
And I understand this was going to be provided for the Santa Cruz 11 hearing today, but unfortunately you were still working on daylight Pacific Standard Time.
I didn't make the time change properly, and although my phone did, but my stove didn't.
So you were late.
I came an hour late.
You had a lot of coffee, and you took it down to Pacific Avenue near Cathcart and Pacific?
On Pacific Avenue in front of IQ and
Taqueria Vallarta?
Near Taqueria Vallarta. There's some, in between is an empty for lease property. And David and I set it up, and Cafe Huff, and gave away free coffee, and gave away street spirits, and all the flyers about the political prisoners. Your flyers, actually, Mr. Roberto.
Was there much of a interest in the flyers?
Well, the host came twice, and the first alarm security guard came. But they left on
Saturday. Did they read the flyers?
No. But they didn't move us along.
What did they say to you?
They said they'd gotten a complaint. Would we just move along up the street? Because they didn't want us there, near their stores.
And your response was?
We're registering voters. Do you know it's a felony to interfere with registering voters?
And to which they replied,
oh.
We'll go back and check with the SCPD and take back Santa Cruz on that.
They threatened to send the police at the beginning. Becky and I started playing good cop, bad cop on them,
How did you do that?
Well, I was like, oh, gee, I'm sorry. I guess we can move it. We were just worried about my back area. And she said, hell no, we're not going to move it. So we have good cop, bad cop. And the guy kind of was won over. We kind of charmed him after it was done. But then the first alarm came, and he wasn't charmable.
And so did you then move, or?
We moved about 10 feet while he was gone, and then let him know that we were not in the same position as when he left.
What was his response to that?
Great, wonderful, wonderful. He told the first alarm, no, these are right. They really complied.
Who told him? Who said that?
The host said that to the first alarm.
I see. And so, what about the complaining merchant? Did she come out and give you a piece of her mind?
Well, he was not allowed to tell us which one it was. But I think everybody knows.
A secret complainant. A secret informant.
Probably IQ. I everybody knows what their attitude is like.
Actually, I have no idea.
Oh, yeah, not very good. Yeah.
So how long did this whole process, how long were you out there for?
Oh, I don't know. A couple hours.
And how many cups of coffee did you give away?
Two pitchers.
Is there cream and sugar?
Yes. There's great cream and sugar available. And thanks to you, we had several flyers.
It was the Butchie Memorial Coffee, perhaps?
quite the opposite. No, quite the opposite.
I see. So you you denounced police abuse downtown?
Well, I explained to him what the First Amendment of the Constitution was.
Explained to who?
The host.
That's educating the host.
Yeah, he felt educated. I don't know. It was all kind of very dumb. I'm glad Becky stood up. I was like, playing the cowering role. Gee, we're so sorry, sir. And she was like, Hell no. You know, she starts quoting numbers and quoting the law, the citations. So when the security guard came, he says, "Gee, she knows the law better than we do."
Right. Well, she's been subjected to the law for these 20 years. Well, David, I want to tell you that, you know, you're offending the merchants downtown, you and this, what's her name, Johnson woman.
Yes.
So I think, as far as I'm concerned, you'd best learn to follow the new rules, the new order, as we like to call it.
The way I look at it is, you know, if those merchants can't adapt to, you know, the Santa Cruz soul and spirit, then they can go to San Jose. We're not going to leave, and the people of Santa Cruz who are truly Santa Cruzans aren't going to leave. But these people who come here and think they can exploit and just get a place on Pacific Avenue and then they start complaining like this is any other city, they're wrong. This is not just any other city.
And we've been talking with that man about Santa Cruz.
David Minton Silva.
Thank you, David.
And I got an email or two. You can, by the way, email me during my show at rnorse3@hotmail.com. This is from Radical Man, with reference to Rebecca Young, the district attorney. Quote, "She is incompetent and lying to cover it up. She should be disbarred." And that's about the assistant district attorney who is pressing on with the persecution and prosecution of the final four of the Santa Cruz 11. And let's see here. Let's hear some more. We're kind of approaching the end of the show, so if you've got some thoughts on any of this and you want to be heard, got to call in, 427-3772.
Speaking with a man or just approached your name, sir?
Hugo Arana.
And Hugo, ¿qué dice?
I want to know if there is any memorial for Jeremy Golay.
And that is the individual who was accused of shooting the two police officers and who was himself shot down by a number of other police officers.
Yeah. Last week I walked by the police station and I brought flowers for the three people who were killed.
Were you arrested?
What?
Well, you know, the other person who brought flowers last week got arrested and was being held in jail as we speak.
I did it in the dark of the night. Nobody saw me.
Oh, a secret memorial to the officers involved.
For the three people.
Well, all three of them, yes. Put out a resolution in favor of bemoaning the deaths of all three people and suggesting that police, urging them not to take out their frustrations on poor and homeless people in Santa Cruz now.
Great. That's good. Great. So police are not going to do that anymore.
Now they have the light of Baker and a butler to guide them. They will mend their ways.
Yeah, well, and it was sad for me to see so many flowers and pictures and cars and everything for two of the three people who died on that Tuesday, because to me, three people of my city died, and I am sad for the death of the three humans, whether in uniforms or not. But one of them was also a citizen who served our country, who had license to bear weapons, who was trained in using weapons, and he did what he was trained to do. The three of them did what they were trained to do. And it's sad that small domestic confrontation ends up in three people dead. And this whole city of Santa Cruz, town of Santa Cruz, needs to mourn those three people, including Jeremy Golay.
Well, there are also, I don't know, 40 to 50 other homeless people who died last year that the same thing might be said for as well.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
So I don't know. The fact that they get a lot of boo-boo hoop-doo in the paper, and frankly, this guy gets trained as a killer Marine because he's going to be one of the great imperialist marchers overseas, implementing domination by U.S. imperialism everywhere, doesn't impress me in the least. And I think it's a sad thing, of course, that, you know, vets get treated like shit, but I don't think if they're anything to glorify, not what the hell they did. No, thank you.
No, they're not to be glorified. They are the mercenaries that the empire sends to other countries to loot the wealth of other countries. And when they come back here with trauma and with weapons and with the right to wear weapons, they are just dumped in towns, in the streets. And no one takes care of them. And that's the sad end in this case. And about 2 years ago, another veteran committed suicide by the waterfront. So here in our town. So they are just being dumped after doing the dirty work for the Pentagon and the ruling class, and that's how.
I tend to agree with you there, stranger. Or Hugo, as you might say. Not Hugo Chavez, that's another guy.
That's another
dead guy.
Sad week for all of us.
Hugo was in the play that I was in with Nicholas about the methyl bromide. And where he played one of the workers.
The name of the play is
Bitter the Fruit.
And the play can be found at...
Good question.
There may be a video of it somewhere.
There's a local video of the first half of it somewhere.
Local playwright Nutcracker Nick Whitehead wrote and directed the play. You wish to end by saying the name of...
Jerome Collet. Rest in peace.
And we might say also human rights and sense and common sense will also be resting in peace in Santa Cruz until such time as someone wishes to dig them up and actually activate them. That's my belief.
Yeah.
Someday. We're talking with...
My name's Alma.
And we're interested in any hassles with police or interesting adventures downtown. How are you feeling about things in the last week?
I'm feeling great, actually.
Well, that's good.
I love Santa Cruz because I'm from somewhere else, and it's way better than everywhere else.
How long have you been here?
Intermittently in the winter for several years.
And have you noticed any change in how people are being treated in Santa Cruz, poor people?
Yes.
And what have you noticed?
I've noticed that it seems harsher at times, and it comes and goes. But
yet you still love Santa Cruz.
Yes, because it's still better than elsewhere. They're treated not so well as they used to be, but that's because they all come here because it's better than everywhere else, I think.
You see more people coming to Santa Cruz or more people leaving Santa
Cruz? No, I don't know.
Right.
I can't say I have enough experience to say.
And it's interesting. You may notice that Alma initially said, oh, they're treated worse because more people come here. And then I asked her more specifically, well, is it your experience you're seeing more people come here? And then she backs off when asked about, you know, her real experience. That, I think, and I would suggest this to other people when you're trying to probe more deeply into issues that are of controversy, like needles being found more frequently than in the past, crimes that some groups like to link up with homeless people. What specifically, you know, have the person you're talking to who's making this claim seen? And I think it's fair to ask the question, not necessarily in a confrontational, accusatory or denunciatory way, but just to ask, to get the information to really determine on what basis the person is speaking. Is she or he reciting, you know, the mantra of the week, such as it seemed that a lot of the people coming to the Santa Cruz City Council's oral communication session at 5 o'clock 2 days ago were doing, and I was going to play some of that today, as well as the Give Us More Money by Monica Martinez on CDBG funding, which happened earlier. Not that I don't think she should necessarily not have it. She just didn't stay to... The only person who stayed to confront this mob of cutback and or cut off needle exchange, defund completely the Homeless Lack of Services Center, which I think is a mistake, critical as I am of the Homeless Lack of Services Center. The only person who stayed was Brent Adams. And you can find his two-minute speech on Santa Cruz Patch, which did a largely lynch mob-loving piece, but also had Brent's piece on there. And you can also find the entire thing on video on the Santa Cruz City Government website, which... wasn't there until I called up yesterday and said, what's going on? Why aren't the videos up? I had to do this last month as well. But a tip of the hat to the office worker, Becky. I don't know her last name. She went to work on this and got those videos posted later on the same day. And thank you very much, Becky, for that good work. I'm really surprised and gratified that can be done. Not that I was happy to hear the voices on the video and see the repeated, you know, I want to say falsification, but again, it sounded like, let's put it this way, a familiar kind of theme repeated over and over again instead of specific concerns about crime stats. Instead, they're It was nothing specific. That was, there was one guy who, and a number of other people who were friends of his, who had his, was poked by a needle or stepped on a needle or somehow, you know, got injected with a needle. And I had asked, in previous shows, I've asked, how often has that happened? And the I haven't really gotten clear answers, except that it apparently happens very infrequently, like, you know, five or six times in the last 5 or 6 years, at least in terms of reported cases. And this literal hysteria, I can't get my children, I have to keep them home in my yard, you know, because they're afraid they're going to get stuck with needles, attacked by homeless people with backpacks, I don't know, seduced by drug addicts, that, you know, it just... It isn't likely a lot of most of that stuff, and it's a form of raising a kind of the pushing the panic button on a group of people that another group of people, Take Back Santa Cruz, wants to get rid of in the downtown area, because it's they don't feel safe with those people, they don't like having them around, they blame them for like merchants do, presumably for, I don't know if they blame them for lack of profitability or lack or business slump, but there's a xenophobic get them gypsy Jews and niggers out of town. You know, it's the fucking Mexicans. You got the gamp Chinese. It's the Japanese. It's the homeless. You know, blame them. So I'm going to try to reach activist Steve Plaich, who I talked to earlier, and see if we can see what he's up to, if he has any new reports on what's going down. Giving him a ding-a-lang here and see if he will pick up the phone. He's running around, as usual, to 100 different meetings. And
better late than never.
Yes, you're picking it up. You have about 3 minutes in which to make a report, Steve Plaich.
Well, you missed a very exciting silent auction for Project Homeless Connect, where everybody, and I mean everybody in Santa Cruz, was there, including your old friend Don Lane, your old friend Brad Adams, pitching his sanctuary camp, your old friend Colin Campbell Clyde. Everybody was there. Except Robert Nuss, of course, who is busily working on free radio.
Well, I would hope that you would call in with an on-the-spot, moment-by-moment account. What, how many people were actually there as a mass? How many did you count?
Oh, probably 100 people.
And what about Annalisa Cube, your old buddy, or Ken Skindog Collins?
No, there were no Take Back Santa Cruz folks there, nor were there any Santa Cruz Neighbors folks there. I didn't see Lynn Robinson. Catherine Byers was there bemoaning the fact that the sleeping ban has been imposed to the library. She was wishing that she could have done something about that, but now that she's off the board, she said it's just a shame.
Indeed. It certainly was a shame that she imposed the sleeping ban on the city when she was mayor, but that's another story.
Well, we're talking about the library.
Yes. Well, let me ask you, Steve, what's coming up in the next few days you think people might find it of interest or maybe important for the community for them to make a presence?
Well, there is a march in remembrance out in Watsonville. It's being organized by Jen Laskin. I think that's tomorrow at 5 o'clock. People can go on Facebook, I think, and find out about it. Of course, there's Women in Black, 5 o'clock tomorrow at the Pacific and Cooper. Saturday, there is the International Women's Day convocation at the Loud Nelson Center between 12 and 3. Pat Arnold will be there, I think, talking. She's the Raging Grannies. Deborah Johnson, if you know Deborah from, I think it's, she's Interlight Faith Community or something. She's very much fire and brimstone, very motivating speaker. And then, you know, just things that are going on as we move through toward another week of trying to fight back the tide of reactionary politics in Santa Cruz.
Did any high-ranking police officials show up at the Project Homeless Connect?
You know, I'm thinking about that, and there really weren't any police officials that I saw. So maybe things are getting a bit segregated between the folks who are advocating for more public safety and the ones who are advocating for more compassionate governance in terms of our social issues, particularly around homelessness.
Did Judge Burdick possibly put in an appearance?
I did not see His Honor there. No, I did not. You, as I said, your old friend Monica Martinez was there. We're talking about commotion at City Council when there were people were calling for the abolition of the Homeless Services Center, so she was feeling a little threatened by that, but everybody was soldiering on.
How about homeless people themselves? How many of them did you count in the room?
Well, there was Brent was there, Colin Campbell was there, there was a guy who actually spoke who is formerly homeless and is kind of a guy who's exemplifies the transition of homeless people from, you know, reduced circumstances to something a little better. If you know Stefan, who was just recently the Tony Hill awardee in the King Convocation, the Homeless Services Center, Stefan was there. So it's more kind of a United Way Homeless Services Center Project Homeless Connect event.
I gotcha. Well, any word on how Needle Exchange is doing? We did hear Martine Bernal state that less needles were found in the beach, lower ocean neighborhood once the city's program was abandoned. I should say the private program that was happening in the city was abandoned, indicating that, somehow casting a shadow of blame on the needle exchange program there, that somehow more needles were left there.
Certainly when you're not exchanging any needles down there at all, you're probably not likely to find any needles being there. I'd like to see some of his statistics that indicate that the presence of needle exchange down there has anything to do with the number of needles that are found.
I gotcha. I know we're hoping to get some stats from Emily Auger about the numbers of needles that were collected in the last 2 years, the number were given out, so we can get some hard facts instead of just the hysteria we're hearing at City Council. You, of course, are one of the record keepers then, and we'll talk to you about that and possibly have you strung up by the thumbs.
Well, we're hoping that next Saturday, a week from tomorrow, a week from this Saturday, when we have the second installment of our Needle Exchange series that Sandra Lee is producing for us over at Clinique TV, Emily will be able to bring some statistics, and we'll be able to kind of chat about that then.
That sounds good. We really appreciate you calling in.
You can call in a needle
on
addict.
Sunday.
Stop him.
Yes, I use needles every show.
And I'm going from the cream to the dregs.
Yes.
Dennis, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
You're on free radio.
Yeah, and I love being on free radio. Those are my people. Yeah, and I think maybe I'll stick around and listen to...
How rude, I must say.
Oh, we botched that one. Oh, well. I think I can play music. Let's try that.
Stay.
And welcome to From the Cream to the Dregs. We've managed to get Robert out of the studio, and on his way, he will return, unfortunately, Monday at 9:30. I mean, Sunday at 9:30, right here on Freak Radio 101.3. For more Bathrobe Spears broadsides, if you can stand it. If you can't stand it, there's plenty of other great stuff on Free Radio. We have an eclectic collection in our collective of programmers, and it's somewhat constantly changing. We don't basically get rid of people, but you know, if this Santa Cruz is a dynamic town, we have programmers who've been on the air for a month, and we've had programmers who've been on the air for a day, and we've had programmers who've been on the air for 17 years. So that's just the way it is. I am Uncle Dennis. This is From the Cream to the Dregs, and every week we engage in an exploration of the music of the 60s and 70s right here on Freak Radio 101.3. Coming up, of course, at 8:30, we'll open the Brew of the Week and share that with you. At 9 o'clock, the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. And of course, a half an hour of that, then back to music. And at 10 o'clock, it's the Ultimate Vinyl Hour, a time when we actually play a record on a turntable with a needle. So we do needle exchange only from turntable 1 to turntable 2. So hopefully that will satisfy you. In terms of getting your life spinning around. So stay tuned. Free Radio could use your donations. If you've got money, send it to Free Radio Santa Cruz, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Thank you very much. Now, here's some Doors.
Show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. Show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar, I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die. Oh, moon of Alabama, now must say goodbye.